for Grace Donnelly, this is the most important thing going on. Chill, Joel. I didn't mean it that way. I sighed. As a man of faith, I refuse to believe in coincidences. It's either God's plan or someone else's, and I don't think God has anything to do with what's happening in this town. Barak kept his own religious beliefs closely guarded, but I could tell by the look in his eyes that I'd struck a chord. I gave Steve the address of Alvin Harrison to punch into the GPS. If anybody knew what was really going on with Finn Donnelly, it would be Alvin. "Are you sure this is a good idea?" Barak asked. "The only bad ideas are the ones that don't work." He didn't say a word. He knew, same as me, that even if we were on the wrong path, we were too far along to turn back now. Chapter 23. Alvin Harrison lived in Brandywine Hills in northern Wilmington. The neighborhood was resplendent with old-world charm. Most of the homes were built in the 30s and 40s, before the suburban boom kicked in, and everything started looking like copies of copies. Beautiful, historic stone houses lined the streets of the hilltop neighborhood. Even the streets were old-timey, with author names like Byron, Milton, and Hawthorne. We parked around the corner from Alvin's apartment building, in front of an elementary schoolyard. There were three kids shooting hoops. Otherwise, the neighborhood was dead. There weren't many cars on the street. Nobody was out walking their dogs or jogging on the sidewalks. Everyone was probably still out to brunch. Barak began to open his door, but I held up a palm. "This guy's been through a lot. What do you think is going to happen if the Secret Service comes knocking on his door?" "Steve can wait in the car," Barak offered. "And let you guys slip away again?" Steve said. "What would you do if I just ran for it?" Barak said. "I mean, if I just took off, zoom, down the sidewalk, led you on a foot race through the middle of town." "I'd chase you. You couldn't keep up," Barak said. "Don't try me," Barak smirked. "If you couldn't catch me, what would you do? Shoot out my kneecaps? That would be worse than losing me." Steve did not look amused. Then again, he never looked amused. "Let him be," I said. "He spent half the night sleeping on the floor of a Waffle Depot bathroom. I think he's been through enough." Barak relented and agreed to sit this one out with Steve. I didn't blame him for wanting to run for it, to be free for just a few minutes. Unless the Obamas hired their own private security, they would be under service protection for the rest of their lives. They would never know the simple pleasures of, say, going grocery shopping without an escort. Of course, Jill did all the grocery shopping in our family, but I imagined it was a simple pleasure. Maybe I'd go with her sometime to find out. Alvin Harrison lived in a two-story brick apartment complex. Unlike the street names, there was nothing quaint about his building. Someone had just plopped a pile of bricks down in the middle of all the mid-Atlantic charm. Judging by the rusted guardrails and faded everything, whoever had built it had also forgotten about it. I scanned a row of mailboxes near the staircase. When Grant dropped Alvin off at the complex, I hadn't seen which apartment he'd gone into. That's where the mailboxes came in. Harrison was penciled in under 23. I slipped on my Ray-Bans and climbed the stairs, which zigzagged up the side of the building. The sky was bright and sunny, with no signs of the clouds the lieutenant had warned us about. When I reached the second floor of apartments, my knee was killing me. I wondered if I couldn't get an injection to temporarily kill the pain. Sports stars did that all the time. A cortisone shot, I think is what they call it. Unfortunately, it would take too long to find a doctor who could ship me up on a weekend. I wasn't about to burden emergency room staff with my sorry behind. I pounded once on Alvin's door. Before I could knock a second time, it swung inward a few inches. It hadn't been shut all the way. "Hello?" I called out. "Alvin?" No answer. "Anybody home? It's Joe. Amtrak Joe." No answer. I pushed the door open a little wider, just enough so I could get a better look inside. There weren't any lights on, and the blinds were pulled shut. I could see the back of a couch from where I was standing. A fat orange tabby rubbed up against my leg. "Hey there, little, big guy," I said. The cat had to weigh 20 pounds. It circled my legs, brushing against me, making little whimpering noises like a hungry dog. I reached down to pet it, and the cat hissed at me before scampering back into the apartment. "Nice to meet you, too," I said. Alvin didn't appear to be home, but the open door had me on edge. I stepped inside the apartment, calling Alvin's name. The cat whined again, louder this time. The fat bastard was sitting on the floor beside the couch, next to an orange prescription bottle. And a shoe. I stepped closer and saw there was a leg in the shoe. And the leg was attached to a person, and the person was sprawled out on the shag rug. Alvin was dead. Chapter 24. When I returned to the Escalade, it was locked. Barack probably stepped out for a coffin nail. He rarely smoked around me because he knew my views on tobacco. I'd always detested cigarettes, even before I launched the cancer moonshot. S! I whipped my head around at the sound of Barack's voice. He hadn't gotten very far. He was playing basketball with the three boys we'd seen earlier. Steve was watching from the edge of the court. Barack had removed his jacket, and his shirt sleeves were rolled up. Back in the White House, this always meant it was time for serious business, but right now he was playing basketball with a group of third and fourth graders. "Where's your baseball cap?" I hissed. "You don't wear baseball caps when you're shooting hoops," he said. One of the boys, a skinny kid with curly hair, shot a basket. It went through the hoop, actually the rim because there wasn't much left of the hoop, and bounced away. Another boy chased it down. "Hey!" the curly-haired boy screamed. Barack fist-bumped him. "Nice shooting, kid. Keep it up, and you could be the next Michael Jordan." The boy scrunched up his face. "I don't want to make shoes. I want to play basketball. Look him up on the YouTubes." The other boy tossed the ball to Barack. "Another round?" Barack told them he'd be back sometime to stump for Delaware's Democratic candidates. "Your parents are all registered to vote, right?" I tugged at his sleeve. "I've got a situation," I whispered. "Alvin is DEA." "We'll see you kids later," Barack said, waving to them. Steve gave them one last glare for good measure and trailed us back to the SUV. Barack unrolled his sleeves and buttoned his cuffs. "Those kids were like 10 years old, Joe. They know how to spell." "Sorry, I'm a little out of sorts." I told Barack the whole story. Steve sat up front, listening intently. Or maybe he was napping behind those sunglasses. "And you're sure Alvin is dead?" Barack said. "Sometimes the pulse can be so faint that you can't feel it on the wrist or neck. He was blue as a smurf." "Okay, okay," Barack said. "We need to figure out what to do. Let me think." "It's obvious what we do," I said. "Call the cops." Barack was doing that pyramid thing with his fingers pressed up to his lips, which meant the wheels in his brain were spinning, as if they ever stopped spinning. "Did you feed the cat?" Barack asked. "You're worried about the cat? I'm just trying to cover all of our bases. If you fed the cat, your fingerprints might be on the cabinets or the food bowl." "I didn't touch anything, not even to feed the cat. He's big enough as it is. On my way out, I wiped my fingerprints off the doorknob and got the HE double hockey sticks out of there." "Good," Barack said. "Let's find a payphone and call it in." "That's going to be a little difficult to do," I said. "Payphones are kind of a rarity these days. We'll find one, though." I crossed my arms. "That's not what I'm talking about. You've been spotted here. Those kids are probably telling their parents right now, or twittering to their friends. Who's going to believe them?" "Who's going to believe them?" I growled. "Esposito, for starters. She knows you're in town. If she hears some kids bragging that they played ball with the ex-commander-in-chief, a black way from a crime scene connected to Finn, she'll put two and two together. By the time Esposito realizes we're in the vicinity of the crime scene, we'll be long gone. We've not broken any laws. I don't think we're going to be hauled off down to the local precinct and questioned. Can you imagine the negative press? Esposito will need time to build a case, and the city board isn't going to let her drag us in without a very, very good reason. By that time, we should either know what's going on, or we'll be victims," I thought. I could tell Barack thought the same thing, but he wasn't willing to say it. Neither of us was. We didn't know what kind of a mess we were getting into, or how deep the roots of the conspiracy went. But make no mistake, there was a conspiracy, all right. It wasn't like we hadn't found ourselves in strange waters and persevered before. Barack had battled the Clinton machine to capture the Democratic Party's nomination in 2008. Together, we'd fought our way to the White House against a Republican Party that called Barack every bad name in the book. We were out in the middle of the sea right now, in uncharted waters with no life jackets. We were paddling with our hands and feet to stay alive. We didn't know which direction to swim because we didn't know where land was. and yet it all felt very familiar. Still, I had to wonder, with this much chum in the water, how soon before we drew the attention of the sharks. Chapter 25. As I stepped into the gas station, the bells on the door handle jingled. The clerk on duty had a handheld plastic fan blowing in her face. She stared at me for a beat, and then went back to watching the fan. I made a beeline for the men's room and did my business. As I dried my hands, I read the descriptions of the various Papa Stoppers for sale in the restroom vending machine. The big metal case on the wall promised all variety of sensual seductions, from glow-in-the-dark rubbers to studded tinglers, for her pleasure. Take your pick. Just 3/4 apiece. I had 3/4, but I wasn't going to blow them on a tingler. Outside the restroom, there was a payphone. It was the 5th gas station we'd stopped at looking for one. I was beginning to think it would have been easier to contact the police via carrier pigeon. I fingered the rosary around my wrist and prayed to Mary that the phone wasn't out of service. I inserted the coins. When the 3/4 clunked down, I heard the dial tone. Who says Jesus doesn't answer small prayers? All you have to do is ask his mother. I dialed the main police number. No sense tying up 911. Alvin didn't need EMTs. He needed a forensic pathologist. A woman answered. Wilmington PD. I'd like to report an overdose. A death. Okay. Do you want the address? Hold on, let me get a pencil, she said with a sigh. Okay, you said someone overdosed? Heroin, pills? There was a bottle of pills. I didn't read it. Is the victim breathing? He's dead. I already told you, he's dead. So no, he's not breathing. Dead men don't breathe. What's your name? Joe Tingler. Okay, Joe. Are you with the victim now? He's back at his apartment. The victim's apartment? Yeah, the dead guy. His name is Alvin Harrison. He lives at the Brandywine Hills Apartments, number 23. Okay, where are you now, Joe? I hung up. Stay on the phone too long and they can trace the call. Heck, the name of the gas station probably showed up in her caller ID. I figured she'd send a unit to Alvin's apartment first. They might check up on the gas station caller later, but Joe Tingler would be on the road by then. I returned to the car. It's done, I said. Did you get my protein bar? Barack asked. I fumbled for the health bar I'd purchased inside the mini-mart. Barack accepted it with a skeptical look. What? I asked. Nothing. It's just, this protein blend is pretty low quality. Look at the label. Hydrolyzed collagen? That won't give you a full spectrum of amino acids. So what are you saying? Did I just waste $4 on a candy bar? Sensing my irritation, Barack unwrapped the bar and took a bite. If the taste bothered him, he was careful to hide it. Is something bothering you, Joe? You mean besides the mounting body count? Fair enough. Here's a crazy idea that just popped into my head. Maybe we have it wrong. He was a 60-something guy, on the verge of retirement, right? Let's say he found something out about Amtrak. They've been cutting corners on passenger safety. That would also explain why he was on his way to see me. He was a whistleblower, and I was the only person he could trust. He had a bunch of documents, so he packed them up and carried them with him. But someone knew. Someone up high. They killed him, then made it look like an overdose. Corporate espionage. Why not? I hate to burst your bubble, but it's just too far-fetched, Barack said. And this is coming from someone who knows state secrets that would scare Ellen straight. He paused, but neither Steve nor I laughed. It was a joke. Sexual orientation is biological in nature, determined by your DNA, meaning it would be impossible to... I get it, I said. Do you really think Finn was a whistleblower? I sighed. No, it's just some fantasy. What's really bothering me is what I'm going to do if I find out Finn wasn't some innocent victim. Marked bills, a gym bag filled with who knows what. I keep telling myself that there's a man's reputation on the line, but maybe that man isn't Finn. Maybe that man is me. What happens if I find out Finn wasn't a good guy? What does that say about me? Before Barack could answer, my phone started buzzing. It was Grace. She was sobbing. Is everything okay? I asked. Two men just showed up with a warrant. They're going through the house right now. Cops? No, she said. DEA. Chapter 26. The Donnelly's home was located in Riverside, one of the roughest neighborhoods in Wilmington. Finn and Darlene had purchased the house in the early 70s, in what was then a post-war community of Irish immigrants. After the nearby East Lake projects closed, its residents, and problems, spilled over into Riverside. Most of their Irish Catholic neighbors packed up and headed to the suburbs. Not the Donnellys. That wasn't Finn's style. By the time I arrived, the DEA had already split. The woman and child who'd been staying at the Donnellys' house were also long gone, spooked off by the break-in earlier in the week. "How long will you be staying in town?" I asked Grace. She was busy stuffing clothes back into a dresser. There was no sense folding them. Everything was headed for the Goodwill, she told me. "I'll be in Wilmington the next week or so, while we get Dad's affairs settled, all the bills paid up. Ann Jessup and I were cleaning the house, getting it in shape so we could list it, and then the DEA came through here and trashed everything. I sent her back to the hotel for now." "I'm sorry you have to deal with this. Did they take anything?" She shook her head. "I know you used to be a lawyer. I couldn't get a hold of the family's attorney, so I just thought, I'm sorry to drag you into this. I didn't know who else to call."
"You did the right thing."
"I don't understand. What would the Drug Enforcement Agency want with my father?" I'd read over the warrant already. The Donnelly's address was indeed listed as the target. The property to be seized, however, was simply listed as anything illegal to be possessed or material evidence to be used in a subsequent criminal prosecution. Boilerplate text. Still, I recognized the judge who'd signed off on it. The document appeared legit. "Let's head into the living room," I said. "We need to talk." She offered me something to drink. Water, tea, coffee. Barack and Steve were waiting down the street in the Escalade. They could wait a little longer. "Warm milk if you have it," I said. I took a seat on the couch. She joined me a few minutes later. "Thanks," I said, taking the milk. I took a sip, a small one, just to judge how hot it was. Instead, I found myself doing my best not to gag. It was the perfect temperature, not too cold, not too hot. Something was off, though. "Is this skim?" I asked. "Almond milk," she said. "Is that all right?" I forced a smile. "Perfect." I set the mug on the side table. In as plain terms as I could, I explained to her what the police had found in her father's pocket. She listened to me, stone-faced, as I told her there was more. A map, with my address on it. That my working theory was that Finn may have had a drug problem and needed my help. I didn't believe for a second that Finn actually did drugs, but what else did the evidence point to? I didn't say anything about the carpet with the possible bloodstains. I stuck to the known facts. And I most definitely didn't say anything about my other theory. Foul play. I didn't want her to lose herself down the same mad road I was on. Not until I knew for sure. Hope was one thing. False hope was another. "What do the police believe?" she asked. "You'd have to ask them," I said. "They didn't tell me any of this." "Think back to when they talked to you. Did they take a statement?" She shook her head. "The only cop I've spoken to is Detective Capriati."
"Capriati?"
"That's it, Detective Capriati." I sighed.
"It may be my fault."
Her eyes went wide. "Not what happened to your father, but why they've kept you in the dark. The part about my address made it to the Secret Service somehow, and I told them to keep a lid on it. I knew the kind of headlines it would generate. I wanted your family to be able to say goodbye without fighting off reporters left and right. I thought the police would at least ask you about any substance abuse in your father's past."
"They may have talked to my aunt," she conceded.
I rubbed my forehead, trying to work out the kinks in my brain. "There wasn't any, you know, any substance abuse in his past," Grace said. "He never even took a drink, I know." I placed a hand on her shoulder. "This has to be a shock. It doesn't feel real." "And it never will," I thought. "You just learn to live with the feeling." We stared across the room at the barren walls. When Finn had rented out the house, he'd apparently pulled everything down. All their paintings. There were still a few personal things left, like a metal train on the mantel. Grace caught me eyeing it. "Dad was the third railroad worker in our family, the first conductor. It was his life." She wiped a tear away. "I thought sometimes that he would have been happier with a son, because a boy might have been more into trains. It sounds silly because I know it's not true. He was so excited to have a child, especially a daughter. He told me that himself,
He called you his little miracle. She laughed. That's because it took them 20 years of trying. Practice makes perfect. The edge of her lips curled up. When I was 13, he asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I said, anything, so long as it doesn't have to do with effing trains. I was a little rebellious, just a tad. I was 13, but I could see the future. Trains were on their way out. They'd been on their way out since the first Model T rolled off the assembly line. I wasn't going to jump on board a sinking ship. Then she excused herself, and I thought about what she'd said. America had been built with trains. That was a long time ago. The steam train was a relic. Passenger light rail was the future, or at least it should have been. Every year, fewer and fewer people were on board with the dream. High-speed trains worked in Europe and Japan, but America was a different beast. Without government funding, passenger trains were money losers. What Americans didn't realize was that without government funding, so were highways and any other form of transportation, public or private. When she returned from the bathroom, I thanked her for the almond milk that I hadn't touched. She walked me to the door. Before I leave, I was wondering, did the cops return a duffel bag to you? It might have been with your father's stuff at the motel. A waitress down at the Waffle Depot mentioned it to me, and it's been bugging me ever since. I'm sure it's nothing. Grace shook her head. Dad had a suitcase at the motel, but that was it. Haven't seen a duffel bag around here either. If it was his, it's missing, just like his watch. His pocket watch? She nodded. The police didn't find it at the scene of the accident. He never went anywhere without it. We assumed it had been stolen out of his room. It could have been in the duffel bag, she shrugged. Maybe the duffel bag was stolen, and the watch was in there? Maybe, I said. I didn't want to say any more. Listen, I should be going. I'll see if I can figure out the deal with the warrant. In the meantime, stay with your aunt at the hotel, if you can. This house has already been broken into once. Through the window slats, I could see a woman walking up the driveway. She had a fine figure, but that's not the first thing I noticed. What really caught my eye was her waist-length blonde hair, pulled back into a ponytail, swinging behind her as she approached the door. Chapter 27. I pushed Grace up against the wall, behind the door. What are you doing? She asked. I shushed her with a finger to my lips. How the woman out front had slipped past Barack, I had no idea. Surely he would have recognized her from the heart of Wilmington. This time she was wearing a bit more than a towel, a white pantsuit and stiletto heels, but it was her. The woman's heels click-clacked on the steps, and the doorbell rang. Grace and I stood silent, flattened against the wall. The doorbell rang again. I looked around for something that I could use as a weapon. No coat rack, no umbrella stand, nothing. I removed one of my sandals. I wasn't planning to attack the woman. I'd never hit a woman in my life. But I had to be ready if she went on the offensive. She'd broken into the motel room. If she tried breaking into the Donnelly's home... The doorbell rang again. She wasn't giving up. See what she wants, I whispered to Grace. I don't understand. Just open the door. I won't let anything bad happen. I raised my sandal with both hands, ready to swing it like a baseball bat. Grace undid the deadbolt and opened the door a crack. Can I help you? The woman's voice was low and muffled, and I couldn't make out a word. Whoever she wasn't selling Girl Scout cookies. They only sell them January through March. Come in, Grace said, opening the door wide and pinning me against the wall. The woman stepped inside. I couldn't see her, but I could smell her. The cloying scent of strawberries and bananas filled the room. I recognized her perfume as one I'd bought for Jill many years back. She never wore it, thank God. Grace started to close the door, and the woman removed her coat. She turned to look for a coat rack and instead came face to face with me, a man with a raised sandal prepared to swing away. She hurled her suit jacket. It caught me right in the face and everything went dark. I dropped my sandal, scrambling to pull off the jacket, but I wasn't fast enough. The woman started beating me like a piñata. I threw up my hands, shielding my face. Grace was shouting something I couldn't understand. I pulled away the suit jacket just in time to see the pointed heel of a black stiletto coming at me. It cracked me on the cheekbone. Remarkably, I stood my ground, bracing myself against the wall. One more whack of that wheel and I knew I'd be licked for sure. You again, the woman said. She lowered her heel but didn't put it back on. Not yet. Grace stepped between us and handed me a business card. This is Abby. I read the card. Abby Todd, Corporate Risk Investigator, Delmar Investigations, Medical Claims, Property Claims, and Life Insurance Claims. Chapter 28. I pressed the package of frozen vegetables to my face. The chill went down to the bone. She'd gotten me good. Too bad I couldn't ice my wounded ego. We were sitting on opposite sides of the couch, a wide gulf between us. My almond milk sat untouched on the table next to me. Perhaps it would be best if Mr. Biden and I talked in private, Abby said. I'm not leaving you two alone, Grace said. Not until somebody tells me what that, and here she pointed to the door, was all about. Mistaken identity, I said. Who were you going to hit with your shoe? Grace asked. It's complicated. Abby glanced over at me. It's not very complicated, is it, Mr. Biden? Would you like me to leave so you can explain to Ms. Donnelly what you were doing at her father's motel room the night of the funeral? What's she talking about, Joe? I sighed. I didn't want to get into this. Not today, but we might as well. I don't believe what happened to your father was an accident. I don't believe that he in any way voluntarily stepped onto those tracks, high or otherwise. I believe he may have been... What I mean to say is, I believe something untoward may have happened to him. Grace threw her hands over her mouth. Well, that certainly sucked the air out of the room. Do the police know about your theory? Abby asked. The Transportation Board has already wrapped their investigation. They've cleared Amtrak of any wrongdoing. The engineer didn't hit him intentionally. Calculating the speed of the train and the amount of time he would have had to brake, there's just no way anyone could have done a better job of braking. That doesn't sound like murder to me. Finn didn't kill himself. I never said he did. I know how your type operate, I said. Frankly, Mr. Biden, I don't believe you know my type. There wasn't anything I could say to that. I'm still investigating, she said. You're a liar. You're hiding something. I know what I'm being lied to. It's funny you should bring that up. Guys, Grace said, please. Abby toyed with the end of her ponytail. If you want to know what I was doing at the motel the other night, I'll tell you. It's no big secret. I'm a private investigator. Most of my clients are insurance companies, and they hire me to investigate suspected fraud. And before you ask, every time a claim has to be paid, the insurance company suspects fraud. That's just the way the industry works. I switched the frozen vegetables from my left hand to my right. It was a California vegetable medley, carrots, broccoli, and cauliflower, three of my least favorites. Abby continued, in the case of an accident like this, I'm interviewing witnesses, family, friends, anyone who can clue me into the victim's state of mind. I also look for physical evidence. Like a note, I said. A suicide note. She nodded. In the event of a victim taking their own life, a third of the time there will be a note. Lately people have been leaving them online, so that makes things easier for us. Paper notes have a way of getting lost. Families want to hush things up, especially if there's insurance money on the line. I can't believe you think we would do something like that, Grace said. I don't believe anything until I have evidence that I'm confident will hold up in civil court. I'm not some amateur sleuthing around on a whim. She smiled icily, but made a point of not looking at me. I was at the motel as part of my routine investigative process. Many deaths occur at motels. If I told you the number, you'd never stay in one again. And there's always a pad of paper on the desk or nightstand, sometimes in the drawer. Rub a pencil over it, and you can see the impression of the last thing someone wrote before tearing the top sheet off. That really works? I asked, dumbfounded. You think Raymond Chandler just plucked it out of thin air? She said. In this case, there was no notepad. There weren't notepads in any of the rooms. It was a dead end. If he just handed me your card at the motel instead of pulling a fast one, I wanted to play things close to the chest, she said, so to speak. I looked away. We didn't need to get into the state of undress Barack and I had found her in. Grace picked up my still-full mug and took it into the kitchen. Abby and I sat in silence again. I felt rotten, like I'd been caught by a truancy officer skipping class to watch a double feature at the Comerford on Wyoming Avenue. When Grace returned, I stood up. "Where do you want the vegetables?" "Keep them," she said flatly. I'd broken her trust. There was nothing I could say to patch things up. Chapter 29. The little beast was still parked two doors down from the Donnellys. The front passenger side door was locked. I waited a few seconds for Steve to unlock it. When I didn't hear the automatic door click, I shielded my eyes and peered through the pitch-black window. Empty. I'd left Steve specific instructions to not leave it unattended. He didn't know what happened to unattended vehicles in this area. I did. A couple of black teenagers with low-slung pants were sitting on a porch behind me. They were passing a cigarette back and forth. I was pretty sure it wasn't tobacco. They were staring at me, trying to figure me out. For the first time, I wondered if my bright Aloha shirt wasn't as inconspicuous as I'd thought. It didn't scream Joe Biden, but it was definitely screaming. "How you kids doing?" I said. They didn't respond. "Joe!" Barack waved from halfway down the block. He had a big gulp cup. Steve was carrying a takeout bag. "That guy was trying to break into your car," one of the teen boys shouted to them. The kid could have been 15 or 16. His hands were buried in the pockets of his hoodie. Barack handed them each $5. "Thanks for watching it, but I know this guy. We're cool." Barack had the keys, and he unlocked the doors. "Get in, Joe." I was opening the passenger door when a polished Ford Galaxy rounded the corner. I tensed up as it rolled slowly down the street, rims spinning. I could feel the bass pumping from the speakers, rattling my fillings. It reached the intersection and sped off. "Is there something bothering you, Joe?" Barack asked. I didn't have a racist bone in my body, but I did have a healthy fear of ending up in the crossfires of a gang shootout. I'd been in war zones before, but many of them paled in comparison to Riverside. Though the neighborhood had a relatively small footprint, it accounted for a hugely disproportionate amount of violent crime in the city. I stammered out a few sounds that only vaguely resembled words, trying to find some way to articulate my concerns about the area without coming across as a bigoted crank. Before I completely embarrassed myself, he mercifully cut in. "Chill. Anyone messes with you, they're messing with me. And I've got two words for you. Predator drones." He opted back. "The DEA warrant looked legit," I said, sliding into the front seat. "I don't know what to do about that just yet. I hadn't expected another agency to get involved. They don't go after low-level users." "We could get in touch with them. If they were sharing information with the Wilmington PD, we should have heard about it." "Esposito's trying to brush us off," Barack said. "Maybe she's giving them the cold shoulder, too." "Dan would know. Except I'm not going to reach out to him until we know more. He might not help us anyway. If he's your friend, he'll find a way. That's what friends do." I ran a hand through my hair. I was due for a trim soon. "I did learn that Grace hasn't seen the duffel bag," I said. "Oh, and there's a watch missing, too." "Expensive?" "Doubt it," I said. "Finn never went for the flashy ones. The cheap ones, they don't last that long, so he was always buying a new one every couple of years. I don't know what his last one looked like." Steve started the SUV. Its 6.2-liter V8 roared to life. "So the Amtrak workers, they all buy their own watches?" Barack asked. "You think Mariano Rivera would take them on with a glove that wasn't his?" I said. "Back in the day, the railroads required engineers and conductors to carry them. They had to be accurate and reliable. There were watch inspectors who checked everything out, even. These days, they can use whatever watch they like, as long as it's in good working condition and displays the time down to the second. A lot of conductors go for vintage pocket watches. Most engineers use wristwatches." "You sure know a lot about trains." "I don't know jack squat about trains. I know a lot about Amtrak. There's a big difference. I'm not a foamer, for Pete's sake." "Speak English, Joe." "A rail fan," I said. "A foamer. It's usually not a complimentary term. They're also called train spotters, rail nuts, hoggers." "Hoggers?" "Don't you start, Barack." A tight-lipped smile spread across his face. "You guys get me something to eat?" I asked. Those vegetables not fill you up? Steve asked. Even he was giving me a hard time now. I squeezed the bag in my hand. It was thawing out and dripping into my lap. About that. I explained the strange encounter and handed the woman's business card to Steve, who called in a request for a background check on her, just to be safe. You've got a little bruising under your eye, Barack said. That's what happens when you take a sandal to a stiletto fight, I thought. I rummaged through the fast food bag. Whatever grilled chicken breasts they'd gotten for themselves were long gone. They'd saved me 3 breaded chicken fingers. No dipping sauce? I asked. There's ketchup in there, Barack said. They had barbecue sauce, but I know you can't handle anything hotter than honey mustard. I told Steve to start the car. Where are we going? Barack asked. Off to interview a witness? Examine a crime scene? Shake down some heavies? I shook my head. We're going to get me some danged barbecue sauce. Chapter 30. I found what I was looking for at the gas station's condiment bar, next to the rack of wieners and taquitos. I pumped a whole coffee cup full of Mad Mark's Southern Pit Viber Extract BBQ sauce. It was a deep burgundy, loaded with pepper flakes. My taste buds burned at the sight of it. Then I grabbed some water for Steve and joined Barack at the counter. He was waiting with a bottled green tea. He had his back to the counter and his cap down, trying to play it cool so he wouldn't be recognized. The girl at the counter was reading a paperback thriller, oblivious to the fact that the 44th President of the United States was leaning back on an elbow right in front of her. If Barack was hidden in plain sight, I was practically invisible. Older Delawareans knew me, but the younger generation and transplants usually looked right past me. The only vice presidents anyone recognized were the ones who had gone on to become president. And Al Gore, who had drawn attention to himself with a beard big enough to have its own zip code. With the 5 o'clock shadows Barack and I were sporting today, we were well on our way to looking like a couple of hippies, too. Barack stared at my cup. What are you trying to prove, Joe? I pointedly ignored him. Hot one out, I announced, tossing a 5 spot on the counter. Barack rolled his eyes. He wanted to get in and out as quickly as possible. However, I was a Delawarean, and Delawareans make small talk. The girl looked out the window. Global warming, she said with a shrug. Actually, it's more of a gradual process than that, Barack said, suddenly interested in our conversation. That's why we prefer the term climate change. What you'll see is a degree or 2 warming over the next 50 years, which will be enough to cause the sea levels to rise 10 feet. When that happens... Is that coffee? The girl asked, pointing to my cup. Barbecue sauce. I have to charge you the same as a coffee. Whatever. Oh, and add his drink, too, I said, motioning to the green tea. I took my change and left Barack at the counter. He was sketching out a diagram on the back of a napkin, trying to explain the complexities of climate change to somebody who probably couldn't count to 20 without taking off her shoes. What's taking him so long? Steve asked, as I slid into the passenger seat and set the barbecue sauce in the cup holder between us. He's giving a seminar on global warming, Steve sighed. We're going to be here a while. What do I owe you for the water? Don't worry about it, I said. The pump stopped. Steve hopped out to take care of things. I snuck a look at the gas pump, curious about the cost of filling the little beast. I saw the dollar amount and nearly choked on my tongue. It was more than the GDP of Rhode Island. Steve returned with a receipt. I hope you get reimbursed for that, I said. I've got the president's card, he said, flashing a platinum Visa. A motorcycle rolled in a couple pumps behind us, on the opposite side. Normally I wouldn't have noticed, but Steve was watching the bike intently in the side mirror. Steve was always watching, watching this, watching that. Movement caught his eye. Lack of movement caught his eye. He was a good agent. You don't remember me, do you? Steve asked. From Wednesday night? From your first term. I was on your detail. I racked my brain to place him, to no luck. I never forgot a face. Secret Service agents, however, were always hiding behind their same sunglasses and same haircuts and same suits and same attitudes. I'm sorry. Were you on my detail long? Close to 8 months, he said. You were kind of a jerk. To you? To all of us. I'd heard the criticism before. Agents had complained, anonymously, to the press about my detachment. They also complained about my swimming habits. Apparently, not everyone wanted to see the Vice President sans trunks. I'm sorry if I gave you a hard time. I didn't care, he said. I don't care. But you brought it up. His eyes flicked to the rearview mirror. I'm the son of a car dealer from Scranton, I said. Having a security detail wasn't the most comfortable thing in the world for me. For what it's worth, following someone around 24/7 isn't the most comfortable thing in the world for us either. I get that. It's just not how I was raised. I wasn't brought up to think I was better than anyone else. Nobody deserved special treatment. The Vice President and his family deserve special treatment. Other protectees were warmer with the agents assigned to protect them. Nobody made friends with their detail, but they treated them like human beings, not human shields. I was afraid of getting too close, I said. Not to you personally, but to all the agents. I couldn't put a name and a face with somebody I knew might be tasked with taking a bullet for me. I'd never be able to live with the guilt. I'd rather take the bullet. It'd be easier to live with. Or die with. Or that. We sat in silence. I could still see Barack inside, at the register, talking animatedly with his hands. The woman behind the counter was, for her part, transfixed. Give him 5 minutes, and Barack could have an atheist singing hymns. We shouldn't hang around here much longer, Steve said. I turned to look for flashing lights in the distance, but there weren't any. We'd stopped at a gas station on the edge of town, where the city turned into country. I'd become increasingly paranoid that Esposito would catch up to us sooner rather than later. The biker was still fielding his Harley. He turned to the side, and I caught a brief glimpse of the large patch covering the back of his leather vest. A giant skull with diamond eyes. The skull was grinning, a dagger between its teeth. Beneath it were the words, Murder Town. The chapter location. The club's name at the top of the vest was obscured by the biker's hair. I've seen that skull before, I said. The skull? Steve said, adjusting the mirror. The guy had turned back around. Steve would have to wait to get a look for himself. The one on the back of his vest, the guy in Darlene's room had a tattoo just like it. You mean the minister? He wasn't a minister. The biker was fiddling with the pump. They make you jump through so many hoops these days just to fill your tank. Is this a debit card? Would you like a car wash? How about a 99-cent coffee? How about some flipping gas? He hasn't been following us, Steve said. How would you know? I'd know. The guy glanced in our direction, then looked away. I'm going inside to get Renegade. You recognize the patch? We've had training on motorcycle clubs. I can't place the design, but it looks familiar. There aren't many with chapters in Wilmington. Climb over here and take the wheel. Meet us out back. Before I could protest, Steve was on his way into the gas station. What I really wanted to happen was for him to detain the biker, see what we could learn about that skull, see if he was in a motorcycle club with the guy who wasn't a minister. Unfortunately, Steve had other plans. I crawled into the driver's seat and turned the key. The little beast roared to life. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Steve emerge from the employee entrance. A beat later, Barack exited behind his human shield. Unfortunately, Steve was a foot too short to be 100% effective, so Barack had to crouch. Let's see what you can do, I said, putting the pedal to the metal. The little beast lurched forward and my head hit the seat back. I pumped the brakes and threw the SUV into reverse in one neat little motion, then spun around toward the employee entrance. I skidded to a stop just inches from backing over Steve and Barack and turning them into gas station hot dog meat. Steve threw the door open, and they tumbled into the back seat. The biker rolled past us and stopped at the road. He threw a lingering look in our direction. The windows were tinted, so I knew he couldn't see me, but he was staring me down nonetheless. He shouted something that I couldn't hear, and gave me a one-fingered salute before tearing off down the two-lane highway. You're not getting away that easy, I thought. I stepped on the gas and we rocketed in reverse. The SUV seemed to pull out from under me, and my head jerked forward. The little beast plowed into an air station before I found the brakes. We screeched to a stop. We sat there for a moment in silence. All three of us were breathing heavily. Air escaped the broken hose somewhere under the vehicle with a high-pitched hiss. I collected myself as best I could, threw the gear shift into drive, and stepped on the gas like my wife was in labor. Chapter 31. I heard the sound of Steve checking the chamber on his gun. I looked in the rear view to see if he was planning to lean out the window and pop off at the biker to blow his tires out, but he'd already reholstered the weapon. "Everybody buckle up back there!" I shouted. "I strongly advise you to pull over," Steve said, "and let this guy get away?" "Yes," I snorted. "Not a chance!" We were heading northwest out of Wilmington on Route 52. The countryside passed by in a blur as we followed close behind the biker, who was zipping in and out of traffic. He must have thought it would be easier to lose us on the country road rather than the tight grid of downtown or the bumper-to-bumper traffic on the interstate. Fortunately, there was one thing the biker hadn't counted on. Weekend drivers. We passed a pickup that was doing 55 in a 55. Clearly a sociopath. Maybe in middle America, it was acceptable to drive the speed limit, but not on the coast. If you weren't doing at least 10 over, you were liable to be run off the road. In Delaware, speeding wasn't breaking the law. It was self-preservation. Barack leaned between the seats. I could tell he was trying to get a look at the speedometer. The needle was fluttering between 80 and 85. No matter how hard I pressed the pedal, the beast wouldn't go any faster. The motorcycle topped out at the same speed, so we were locked in step with each other. "Listen, I know he flipped you off, but this is madness. It was just a middle finger. It's not worth getting into an accident. He knows us. He knows that we know who he is." "And who is he?" Barack asked. "I don't know his name, but I know that skull on his back. His club has something to do with Finn, and he's just flaunting it in our faces. He was mocking us back there." "He's not going to pull over. That much is obvious. What are you planning to do?" I didn't say anything. "How are we on gas?" Barack said. The tank was three-quarters full, and he knew it. "If you want to drive, you're more than welcome to. You're doing a great job, Joel." "You mean that?" "Could I give you a suggestion, though?" I shook my head. Barack ignored me. "You might want to move your hands down a notch. 10 and 2 used to be the recommendation, but experts now say 9 and 3 are better. In a crash, the airbag can break your wrists if your hands are too high in the wheel. That what they teach you at Harvard driving school?" He didn't take the bait. I waited for him to look away, and then I slipped my hands down the wheel to 9 and 3. The motorcycle whipped around a mid-sized sedan with Vermont plates, and I did the same, keeping pace. As we passed the sedan, I caught a glimpse of a small tuft of white hair poking out above the bottom of the window. The driver's head was so low, it was a miracle he could see. A pair of bony hands hung from the steering wheel like Halloween decorations. "Everybody wave to Bernie," I said. Nobody laughed at my joke. Developed land segued into fields and farms. Weekend drivers loved driving past fields for some reason. There wasn't much to see right now. The corn was barely a foot high. Other crops hadn't started poking up yet. The biker occasionally checked us out in his side mirror, but didn't slow. Which one of us was going to make a mistake first? "You know what the official state beverage is?" I said out loud. There was no answer from the back. "Give up? I'll tell you. It's milk. Milk is the official state beverage of Delaware." "Fascinating," Barack said. "I know, right?" I said, glancing in the rear view to see if he was rolling his eyes. He wasn't. "Cow," Steve said. I looked at Steve. "Yeah, though we've got goats in Delaware, too. You know what gets me, though? Almond milk. It's not milk, it's more like juice. Just call it almond juice. Cow!" Stephen Perrock screamed, pointing through the windshield. My eyes returned to the road just in time to see a large black-spotted dairy cow in the middle of our lane. In the opposite lane was a semi coming right toward us. I pumped the brakes and spun the wheel hard to the right, praying silently to St. Francis that we wouldn't crash. My prayer must have gone to St. Francis's voicemail. We skidded around the cow, which had a very nonchalant look on its face given the situation. The anti-lock braking system kicked in and prevented the brakes from locking up and sending us ass over teacup, but it couldn't prevent us from diving headfirst into the ditch. The little beast rocketed up the opposite embankment. We tore through a barbed wire fence like it was nothing more than party streamers, and then we were in a field. The car rocked back and forth over the uneven dirt, going slower and slower until finally rolling to a stop. That's the last thing I remembered before blacking out. Chapter 32. When I came to, I was still in the driver's seat. My eyes were burning. Not due to an injury, but due to the barbecue sauce that had splattered all over the dash. Steve was slumped over in the back, blood trickling down the side of his face. Peroxide was empty. I stumbled outside. The smell of burnt rubber filled my nostrils. There were deep scars in the field from the tires all the way back to the road. The Escalade had left 50-foot-long black skid marks on the highway. We'd come to a stop just short of a herd of cattle, which hadn't taken much notice of us. I counted 12 of them, in addition to the cow that had somehow wandered onto the highway, a baker's dozen. I heard the trunk slam shut. Brock? He peeked around the corner of the car. You're awake. I was just coming to check on you. He was holding a first aid kit. I'm fine, I said. You're sure? You hit the steering wheel pretty hard. I touched my forehead and found a knot. I didn't remember going headfirst into the wheel, but I must have. You feeling nauseous? Brain fog? Not any worse than usual, I said. You're making jokes, so you can't be too out of it, Barack said. He opened the rear driver's side door. Now that the smell of burnt rubber was dissipating, another smell took over. I looked down at my feet. I was inches away from a pile of manure. We were in the middle of a fecal minefield. Barack peered back at me. Oh, and watch your step. I've been on farms before, I said. We both had. A couple of summers we'd spent more time in Iowa than in Washington. That was what you had to do if you wanted to win the First in the Nation caucus. My only regret was that with all the cows I'd milked in the state fair over the years, I'd never won the state Democratic Party's nomination for president. Never even came close. At least there'd been ice cream. I peeked over Barack's shoulder. Steve was awake, but he didn't look good. There was a glassy look in his eyes. Steve wasn't an agent, I realized. He was a human being. A human being in pain. He hadn't asked to be dragged along on this quixotic quest. He'd only come along because he didn't want a black mark on his record. Not when he was so close to getting a spot on the presidential counter-assault team. We'd taken advantage of him, and he didn't deserve this. Still, he should have been wearing a seatbelt. Barack carefully wrapped gauze around Steve's head. There's a cut along his hairline. The scalp bleeds more readily than any other part of the body, except for arteries, of course. Of course, I said, though I had no idea what he was talking about. Barack didn't have any medical training, as far as I knew, but his brain absorbed everything. If it came down to it, I had faith that he could deliver a baby, maybe even perform a circumcision. He's definitely got a concussion, but what worries me is internal bleeding. He wasn't buckled in. He flew into the back of your seat pretty hard. Steve squinted at me. Was it the Russians? The Russians? I asked, squeezing his hand. It was cold and sweaty. They're trying to tamper with the election. We have to stop them. Barack frowned at me. What happened? Steve asked. They won, didn't they? We were chasing a biker, I told him. Do you remember that? Steve coughed into his hand. There was fresh blood in his cough. The Marauders. Have you called the meat wagon? I asked Barack. There isn't an ambulance in Delaware that could make it through the mud in this field. Don't think they're going to land a helicopter here either, at least not without some trouble. We'll take him ourselves, as long as the little beast starts. Sounds like a plan, I said. That's because it is a plan, Joe. The Marauders, Steve said again. Barack shook his head. Hand me the keys, Joe. We need to get on the road. It was his car, so that was fine by me. Or it was his wife's, actually. Despite everything I'd driven it through, the little beast wasn't in bad shape. It was bulletproof and apparently barbed wire proof. At least I hadn't hit the cow. No car is cow-proof. The Marauders, I said, trying the word out on my tongue. Steve wasn't talking about the Russians. He was drifting in and out of lucidity, but he was trying to tell us something. The Marauders. I snapped my fingers. The MC! We don't have time to talk hip-hop, Barack said. The keys. Not an MC, an MC! Motorcycle Club! The Marauders! Steve started to nod, but winced. He grabbed his ribs. He was trying to tough it out, but it was hard to hide his pain. He was a soldier, but even the best soldiers can go down. His eyes kept wandering, never stopping long enough to focus. He was fading fast. The last thing he said before passing out was, "Are those cows?" Chapter 33. After we dropped off Steve at the nearest hospital, Barack pulled into a nondescript garage and parked in the basement, the last spot in a long line of cars. There was a thin layer of water on the cement. Either there was nowhere for it to drain, or it was so thick with motor oil and sludge that it couldn't move. "This is all my fault," I said. "I'm the one who got us into this mess. I'm the one who couldn't handle the car." Barack didn't look at me. He was behind the wheel now. "You're being too hard on yourself, Joe." "Am I wrong?" "About which part?" "Any of it," I said. "I shouldn't have let you drive in the first place. The little beast takes some getting used to. How many fields have you driven her into?" "Zero." I felt a yawn coming on and covered my mouth. I was able to avoid it, but my energy was flagging. The car chase had gotten my heart rate up. Adrenaline was coursing through my body. Everything felt electric. My fingertips were tingling, abuzz with energy. And then I crashed. In more ways than one. A boat of a car crept past us. An olive-green 1973 Cadillac Fleetwood. It stopped, then backed up into a space directly behind us. I watched over my shoulder as it flashed its headlights. Once, twice, three times. That was the signal. Barack and I stepped out and slipped into the back seat of the Fleetwood. Detective Capriotti didn't turn around. "Thanks for meeting us," I said. "I wouldn't have called if it wasn't important. Should we drive somewhere?" "I've already been put on traffic duty for a week. I could be fired just for talking to you. Let alone, I didn't know you were going to bring him." "Sorry," I said. "Dan, this is Barack. Barack, Dan." They shook hands between the front seats. Neither man smiled. "We need your help," I said. "I'm wondering if I haven't helped you enough already. I told you what we found in your friend's pockets because I thought you'd appreciate it. The lieutenant gets a call an hour ago from Finn Donnelly's daughter, who's all pissed off that we kept it from her. Now where do you suppose she learned about the drugs, Joe?" "She's family. I assumed she knew." "I told you she didn't. Or are you forgetting things in your old age?" "I thought..." My voice trailed off. "It doesn't matter now. I'm not finished. A couple of days ago I got a call from you, telling me I need to check up on some guy you thought might be snooping around Finn's wife's room. Nobody there knew anything about some minister. He wasn't a minister. First he was, then he wasn't. Do you hear yourself? This is paranoia." He shook his head. "Then there's this." Dan unfolded a paper and passed it back to me. It was a sketch of the actor Richard Gere. "I don't understand," I said. "We got a call about 10:30 this morning," Dan said. "Alvin Harrison died of an overdose. Oxy, from the looks of it." I tried to look shocked, but I couldn't fool Dan. He continued. "A neighbor described a suspicious character snooping around Alvin's apartment. She's one of those ladies who watches everything out her window. You know that type. Anyway, the only problem is she's not quite all there. Mentally, if you know what I mean. The description she gave the sketch artist was quite detailed, though." He paused for effect. "You wouldn't happen to know anything about Alvin's death, would you?" Barack examined the drawing, and then me. Back and forth. He bit his lip. "Talk to Richard Gere," I said, handing the paper back to Dan. "He's from Philly. He could have been in town. You never know." "So this is how it's going to be, Joe. I didn't call you to discuss Alvin Harrison," I said. "I need to know if you know anything about the Marauders." "The outlaw biker gang? You want to let me know what's going on?" "Not particularly," I said. "I hope this doesn't have anything to do with Finn Donnelly. If I say it does, are you going to tell me off? You want my help? I need to know where this is coming from. There's no connection between the Marauders and your friend." "The Marauders aren't involved in the drug trade?" Dan shrugged. "I'm not a narcotics detective, but their name pops up now and again. Marijuana, guns, I guess. The usual outlaw biker stuff." "And you don't shut them down?" "We have to pick and choose our battles, Joe. Half of this city is high on something right now. Should we just start kicking in doors without warrants? Unless they start trouble, we keep out of their business." "You're saying because they're white, you don't hassle them," Barack said. "You don't know me," Dan snapped. I felt a tension headache coming on. It could have been the after effects of the concussion. It could have had nothing to do with the concussion. I said, "The guy I ran into at Baptist Manor the other day was part of their club. Finn wasn't, obviously. He didn't even own a bike, but maybe he hung with them. Maybe they're the ones who sold him his dope. Dan laughed.